Yeah, I'd like everybody to welcome Jimmy Eat.
Thank you. I'm Jimmy, Powers Over Alcohol. I'm extremely grateful to be here. Grateful to see all of you here. I've been messing up ever since I came in here. I'm the fellow that spilled that drink over there. And that's the first drink I spilled in 28 years. So I'm getting better. And we all will if we as I explained to that young lady when I gave her the big book. You read the big book, you believe what it says, but you still don't own any of it until you practice it in your life. That's when you own it. That's when it becomes part of you. Everything you learn and hear in these rooms is just words and nothing else unless you practice it in your life. So that's where we begin. And boy, I tell you, this was great. You come here and I says, wow, they go out like this for Christmas party. I was telling my designated drivers, Erica and Deborah over here, I said, we got to make reservations here for New Year's Eve. This is great. But, and so are you, and so are all of you. And that's what's great about this AA program, that we can all meet like this and get together and have good fellowship and understand the fact that each and every one of us, what we've gone through, you know, if you've been there, you really know it. And you know, that brings me to think about something someone used to tell me all the time. Well, you know, Jimmy, whether you got 1 year, 2 years, or 28 years, you're only one drink away from a drunk. And isn't that kind of what they call fragile sobriety? And you know, I says, well, you might be right there, you know, in one sense. 28 years, I haven't had one, but if I took one drink, it isn't that Jimmy's had a drink. It's that Jimmy is drinking again. Because if I can have one today and want to, then I'll try two tomorrow, and maybe three the next day. I'll be drinking again. And that's the illness of alcoholism. But you know, there is a difference. The big book tells us about the quality of sobriety. In other words, we're all one thought away from a drink. And that's one thought away from a drunk. If I pick up this microphone, I can't do it until I think about it first. I can't get out of that chair until I think about it first. I can't reach into my pocket unless I think about it first. And I can't pick up a drink of alcohol unless I think about it first. And that's what's important. That's what's important, my friends. You see, if I'm spiritually sound, I have spiritual fulfillment, spiritual embodiment. The thought of a drink is not on that plane. I'm lifted up to a different plane. That's why, you know, anything traumatic or devastating happens in the course of my life, in the course of a day, never once does my mind go to taking a drink. If your mind goes to the thought that maybe a drink would help, or maybe you should drink, or maybe you might as well just get drunk because, then that's not a spiritual mind. That's an alcoholic thought. That's the alcoholic mind. That's the same mind that you had when you first came in these rooms. I came in here with an alcoholic mind. After I put down the drink a day at a time for quite a while, I didn't understand the fact that I still wanted to drink until I started to attest myself to the spiritual concept of this program. And that's when that all leaves. And then you're lifted above it, like I say. And it's like a suit of armor. So even though I'm only one drink away from a drunk, I'm only one thought away from taking that drink. And if I'm not down in the alcoholic level, if I do not still retain the alcoholic mind, that thought will not enter into my mind. Always remember this. There's nothing I can do that isn't first preceded by a thought. Now, some people may disagree, but I'll tell you this, and this is one to take to bed with you tonight. The body is the servant of the mind. There isn't anything I can do physically without thinking about it first. Because if there was, there'd be no such thing as convicting criminals of any acts they did. Their defense would simply be, my mind told me not to, but my body did it anyway. So anytime someone picks up a drink as an alcoholic, I've never gone back out. I don't knock it. I don't know what goes through their mind. But I do know this, and you know this too. It is not a spiritual thought for an alcoholic to pick up another drink. I'm not talking about people brand new just coming in and still sitting on their hands and still nervous and upset like I was in the beginning. I'm talking about somebody with a little bit of measure of sobriety. It is not a spiritual thought to pick up a drink again. It's an alcoholic thought. And the same mind that I came in here with will always want to drink again. It will never be content in these rooms, never. Because the alcoholic mind will always want to drink. And it'll always connive and find a way that it possibly could drink. So always remember that. Unless we change our thinking, unless we become born again in thought, we'll never be comfortable in our sobriety, as we call it. And it's really not sobriety, because sobriety to me, my friends, is not drinking a day at a time in absence of inner turmoil. In absence of that inner turmoil, anger, resentment, pity, guilt, fears. You see, we can rid ourselves of that. Many people don't believe that, and that's simply because the human or carnal mind rejects that which it doesn't understand. It rejects it. Whatever things, sometimes spiritual concepts in this AA program sound foreign and therefore uncomfortable to the alcoholic mind, and always will. The fact that I don't drink a day at a time and I never think of drinking isn't very well understood by the alcoholic mind if they know that I'm alcoholic. So that's what's important. The fact that we must do our change, and it must be a spiritual change. Without that change, my friends, we will never be at what I call sober, just not drinking. And the person that's just not drinking, that's all it is. He's not enjoying himself and never will. So that's just the basis of what I like to talk about, is in sobriety. And you know, it wasn't this way in my life all the time. I remember I was almost 19 years old when I took my first drink. And in high school, I had won the Golden Gloves up there, the light heavyweight championship, and I campaigned in Canada and Pennsylvania, Northern New York, as a light heavyweight champion up there, amateur champion, and then I turned pro, and just before I turned pro, I started drinking. I didn't really want to drink, but I took one drink, and my God, I couldn't believe it. I just took one, and I wanted another, and I wanted another, and then see, that's the alcoholism in me. My system just craved it. And then I was spending more time in the saloons than I was in the gymnasiums. And I started to receive one of the worst feelings of my life. Almost as bad as some of those headaches and heartaches and hangovers of alcoholism. I started to feel what it was like to lose to someone that you knew you could beat simply because you weren't in good condition. It wasn't in good condition because the real answer was I was drinking. But in alcoholism is a disease of denial. I was always saying, well, I just didn't get in good shape, or I ate too much, or whatever. And see, that's a disease of denial, and this is a disease of denial. We hear it a lot from people who are heavy drinkers and say, well, you know, I can quit anytime I want. Well, I could too, but then start up again right away. You know, it's staying stopped that's important. And we cannot stay stopped, you know, healthily without this 12-step program and understanding the 12 steps and traditions of AA and engendering into a spiritual change. So all this is so very important. And but you know, as I went along, I continued to drink, and the promoters were backing off me because I was becoming a risk. And I got involved with the underworld figures, and let me tell you, not talking about hubcap thieves, I'm talking about, you know, like the Soprano type people. Well, let me tell you this, they're trying to be like we were. Well, that's what they're getting their education from. But that's what it was, and I was heavily involved with underworld figures and whatever. And I began to pay the consequences of that way of thinking. Now you can say, well, no, you mean that way of living. No, that way of thinking. See, I can't live that way till I think that way first. Always remember this. This is very important in your life, to understand that Everything I do is preceded by a thought. You know, that light bulb first was an idea. Thomas Edison, he perfected that little filament that would burn consistently. You know that over 1,100 experiments he made, and somebody said to him once, before he discovered it, and someone said to him once, you know, after about 400 or 500, you must have got pretty discouraged. And he says, well, no, after 400 or 500, I just found out that was 400 or 500 ways it wouldn't work. And see, he was persistent and he got it. And if we stay persistent in our program, we'll get it. It's here for all of us. But anyway, I remember just briefly, you know, I got what they call a safe conviction in I'm back in the 50s, I don't know where you people were then. And safe conviction, that's taking money out of a safe that don't belong to you. And it was right across the highway from the state police and barracks, and they were pretty dumbfounded by it. But I was fortunate, I thought, in getting 5 years probation. But a year later, I got violated my probation for some kind of a jewel theft. And I got a year in the pen, and I come out of there, and it was a hot day in September. Remember, I was very thirsty. And the friends were grabbing me back to my hometown, Syracuse, and we stopped for a drink, and I thought it would take maybe 3 or 4 bottles of beer, 5 or 6, to get drunk, because I hadn't drank in about 8 months. But it was only that first bottle, it was only about half far gone, that I had that familiar buzz on. Because, once again, the progression of alcoholism is going on inside me all the time. I haven't drank in 28 years, but if I took one drink right now, it would be as if I was right back to the same time that I took my last one. It would have just as devastated me just as much as that one would. So anyway, I come back to Syracuse, and you know, it was in 1961. I got married, and I went on my honeymoon in Baltimore, Maryland. Actually, I went on the honeymoon to Maryland because I was really on the lam. Grand jury was sitting on what they call flim-flam or confidence scores, con schemes. And I don't know how many of you in this room ever got extradited on your honeymoon, but I did, and it don't make for the beginning of a very good marriage. But anyway, I got trial, went to trial, and I got acquitted, and I was a big man in the underworld now and whatever, and things went on. And 1 year in 1964, please believe me, 1 year, it was just a pursuit of alcohol. Alcohol and the pursuit of alcohol, and I didn't realize that. But I got indicted down in Buffalo, New York, 9 counts of forgery. The state's attorney steps in and says, this man isn't writing or passing checks. What he's doing is he's running a statewide forgery ring, and we got to shut it down. Well, I made bail, and I went back down to Dauphin County in Syracuse, and I got indicted on 54 counts of forgery. This is in 1964. And I made bail, and I went back out on the streets, and I got indicted again. In Onondaga County. This time was accessory to robbery in the first degree. And I made bail and I went back out on the streets, and this time I got indicted on robbery in the first degree. And now the bonding companies thought I was becoming a risk, and they kind of backed off, and the judge put some super high bail on me, and it was, you know, it didn't look too good at the time. So my lawyer told me, well, Jimmy, I don't know, we got a lot of indictments here, and he says, it's going to cost some more money. He says, I don't know what you're going to do, but I got to get some more money. And I says, well, I've been getting you more money. I says, but every time I go out and get you money, I get another indictment with it. So I sent for some pajamas and whatever. In the summer of 1964, I got indicted by the federal government. And this was on a $450,000 postal money order swindle. And they didn't put any bail on me. And so now I knew that I was in hot water. But we went to trial about a year later on the robbery one, and I had one conviction, a safe cracking, and a second conviction was, maximum was 60 years. And you know, but when I was in that county jail, I remember this clearly. I was a different guy. I wasn't conning or scheming or whatever. I was reaching out to other fellas in there. I was a high school dropout, but I could express myself, and I was helping guys write letters and helping some guys with their attorneys and whatever, and keeping their families together, and all around good guy. And but anyway, I went to trial on the robbery one, and I got convicted. Couldn't believe it. And well, it was a funny thing when the jury come back, you know, a lot of people just learned about juries around the O.J. Simpson time there, see, but I understood them all, and I knew when they come out, and the men won't look at you, they'll look up at the ceiling, and the women are dabbing their eyes with their handkerchiefs. I mean, why, when they convict you, do they cry? I don't know. But anyway, my lawyer leaned over and he said to me, "We're dead." And I thought of the 60 years, and I says, "What do you mean we, Frank?" I mean, I knew I was the one who was going to have to do the time. Well, anyway, we contested the constitutionality of this hit. I mean, it was almost another year before I got sentenced. And I continued to be a good guy in the joint, in the jail there. I was really, you know, and you see the changing in thinking. You want to start creating miracles in your own life right away. I mean, instantly. I mean, like right away tonight. And just change your thinking. Improve your thinking. If I want a better life, I have to improve my mind. Well, anyway, I went up for sentencing, and instead of giving me 60 years, that judge only gave me 40. And boy, I felt great. He set me up the Attica prison where that infamous riot was and whatever. And then I transferred down to Auburn prison. And I don't want to go through all this, but I continued in a sense. I was looking at myself. It wasn't this 40-foot walls that bothered me that much. It wasn't the slamming of the iron doors. That's why they call it the slammers. It wasn't the concrete floors and steel walls. It wasn't the cold water flat, as you might call it. It was myself. What was I doing to myself? And I figured I owed myself a better life than this. But never once known that it was alcohol and the pursuit of alcohol that had put me in that place, that had given me that time. I didn't realize that. So what happened was, I became a leader in prison, but I was leading the fellows in the right direction, encouraging them to go to school and whatever and this and that. And here, you know, I don't know where all this was coming from, but I guess it was an urging or a calling from my God, and I didn't really understand it. And so after the Attica riot, that infamous riot that they make so many documentaries on, you know, and where the state police come in with the riot guns and the tear gas whatever. They modified the old law. I was supposed to do 13 years and 9 months to see the parole board. And they said they modified it to 8 years and 4 months. And I had almost 8 years in. But I went to the parole board. I was not supposed to get out. I already got a big break by modifying the law and whatever. And besides, I had 4 indictments from the state and 1 from the federal government. They weren't going to let me out. But they did. They told me to go home. And when I left that prison, that's miracle number one in changing my thinking. When I left that prison and went out in front, I was waiting for the state authorities or the federal authorities to fight over me. Who was going to take me and prosecute me? But neither one was there. Just my friends had picked me up, and I left. And you know, that was in 1973, and I haven't heard a word of those indictments since then. See, my God knows your heart, and when you are sincere, some of these problems just evaporate like cigarette smoke. They just evaporate out of your life, and you have to believe that, my friends. So it came time now. I drank for almost a year because I didn't know alcohol was my problem. Then I was led to the AA program. I no more than come into AA, and I was still sincere. When parole called me up and said, "You know, Jimmy, when you got out, you owed 31 years and change on parole. And tell you what, you give us 5 good years from the day you got out. It ain't mandatory, but we can get you off parole." And you know, I never really tried to do anything to get off parole. I just practiced this program in my life and it complemented parole. And after 5 years, I was released. These are miracles of changing my thinking. Miracles. And they can happen in your life too if you believe it. And if you don't believe it, you can't have that which you don't believe. We all get that what we believe in. And that's a spiritual law. Don't forget that one. So anyway, now I'm free from. But I remember when I first came into AA and I says, I've quitted them rooms, you know, and I don't see them here because we had the luncheon, but there's an area room that have the little signs up, think, let go and let God, and like that. And one old timer got up and he said that we have a motto here, easy does it, but do it. And I says, well, I had a motto in my old life. And he said, what was that? I said, take it easy, but take it. And he said, well, look what it got you, Jimmy. It got you 40 years in the joint. So I began to realize these little words was philosophy. They were expert philosophy to pattern my life after. There was nothing childish about this program. And I had to understand that. And so as I went along, you know, and I still didn't feel comfortable at all without a drink. But finally the urge to drink left me as I started to grow spiritually. And I can't believe what happened in my life. It was just dynamic. More things were going on that just seemed, you know, problem things that just seemed to evaporate. And I remembered the miracles that happened because of my change in thinking. And I said, I'm going to continue, and I'm going to continue to go spiritually. I'm going to do everything I can to get all I can out of this AA program. Some people say, well, this was a selfish program. And a guy raised that question a while ago. And he said, well, this is if it's a selfish program, and I said, you got to understand what it means. It means that you got to be selfish to do whatever you got to do and stay sober and to grow spiritually. A fellow was going to, he had almost a year's sobriety, and they had a New Year's party, Christmas party, office party. His wife worked for a big corporation, and she wanted him to come because they brought their husbands and boyfriends and whatever, and she wanted him there. But he had almost a year's sobriety, and he didn't want to go. He didn't feel comfortable. He thought, you know, because they're drinking and whatever. And so that's when I explained it to him. I said, if you feel uncomfortable to bring this up at an AA meeting, you better not go. And if you don't go, your wife has to understand, or does she want you drinking again? And I said, this is the selfish part of the program. We have to stay selfish to stay sober sometimes. But it doesn't mean that we hurt anyone else in our lives by being selfish. It means we do it for our own spiritual gain, and there's no greater gain in life than spiritual gain. And another fellow had a real problem with making amends. Thanks, Nate. Watch me spill this one. Thanks, little buddy. He had been sober a little while, but his mother-in-law would never forgive him for the way he treated her daughter. And I guess the word was that he never really physically hurt her, but, you know, mentally and emotionally, and not being there for the kids and all. And the mother-in-law would never forgive him for it, and it was bothering him quite a bit. And I said, well, you got to understand the purpose of this, of making amends. You see, when we come into the AA program, we put down a drink a day at a time, what we're really doing is releasing ourselves from the bondage of self. The bondage of self is caused by our own wrong thinking, which gives us those knots in the belly, those angers, resentments, pity, guilt, and whatever. So what we're trying to do is free ourselves up from that. And what he was doing was he was still letting it bother him because his mother-in-law wouldn't accept his forgiveness, asking her to forgive him. And I said, well, understand this, now she has the problem. If she's knocking you because you're trying to better yourself in life, she does have a problem. And you and her daughter are getting along great now, and you're a sober man, and you got a good job. So she's just trying to hold it against him for some reason, see. Some people want you to feel guilty. Some children, as they grow older, pull that on their parents. You weren't here when I needed you, and this and that. Well, I wasn't there for my daughter either, but she understands that I'm a better man now. You know, I may not be the man I ought to be. I may not be the man I should be, but thank God I'm not the man I used to be. And that's what's important through sobriety. So I said to him, I says, you're talking about your mother-in-law. They said, well, she won't forgive you. You can't make amends to your mother-in-law. And he says, no. I said, let me tell you something, my friend. The year of 1964, I got 4 indictments from the state of New York. Each one of those indictments read the people of the state of New York versus Jimmy Egan. Now that's a lot of people that they have to make amends to. And I said, In the summer of 1964, I got an indictment from the U.S. government. That one read, "The People of the United States of America versus James Egan." That's everybody in the country. And you know what? I can't go out and apologize to them all. I mean, how many stamps would I have to buy? How many letters would I have to write? How many phone books would I have to go through? But there is one way. There is one way I can make amends to them, myself, and everyone else. And that is by what I do today. What I do today is so important. You know, the power of example. I may not be able to say I'm sorry to everyone that I hurt. But if they can see me in my change, in my spiritual growth, and the fact that I'm reaching out to others to help them too, my God, if they don't forgive me then, like I say, they have a problem. And there are many out there with that type of problem. We have to ignore it. And hopefully someday they'll change like we do. But always remember this. As you grow spiritually, you become more foreign to people who are not growing spiritually because they don't understand it. But always remember this. They're living without a program. You're living with one. And so you have to, in a sense, understand that they may not always act or react the way you think they should. But the thing is God bless them and hope someday, if we are thinking better, that they will be too. And that's what's important, my friends, improving our thinking. You know, so many people, I've seen people, you know, I was going to say to a guy once, he says, well, what's all this spirituality and spiritual growth, Jimmy? And what's it? You know, if I took this and it was a cup of dirty dishwater, and everyone in the room knew this was a cup of dirty dishwater, and you knew that I knew it was a cup of dirty dishwater, and I went like this. God, Nate, you gave me dirty dishwater. No, he didn't. That's clear water. But if I drank it, you'd say there's something wrong with that guy. Not only that, he's going to get a sick or a sour stomach. And I probably would, knowingly and willingly. Yet how can we afford to put sick, sour thoughts in our minds and okay it? You know, I know a guy that has an automobile. It's not brand new, but it's close to it. It's like candy apple red. He's got the chrome shining, the seats polished. Oh, unbelievable. Rain a speck of dust on it. And don't try to put any on it. You know what I mean? His girlfriend couldn't get in the car with a Coke in her hand. She might spill it. You know, and yet every time he talked, the filth that come out of his mouth, it shows us where's our values. We must have a value system somewhere in us. We must place our values in something other than material things. Place our values in something that will bring us closer to God and closer to one another. And that's what spiritual growth is and spirituality is. And someone says, you know, Jimmy, I don't know, every time, I can't believe you can go a week or two without getting angry. Everybody gets angry. And I say, well, I'll tell you, my friend, you may think that, I said, but what you're telling me then is that you don't believe you can go a week or two without getting angry. I says, I can't remember, and I'm talking in a period of years, the last time I got angry. You know what anger is, you know, losing yourself, damn this and kicking and whatever. That's anger. I can't remember the last time. And you know why? Because I don't have no value in my life anymore. And the guy says, I says, every time you tell me you don't, I says, all you're telling me that you don't believe that you can go a while without being angry. And so anger, resentment, pity, guilt, you know, 28 years I haven't had a drink of alcohol, and at one time the most obsessive, compulsive feeling I ever had in my life was to drink a day at a time. A drink a day at a time. Look what it did to me, and I know what it did to most of you. When I went to prison that time, I lost a good career. I was a pretty good fighter. I mean, I don't know how far I would have went, but I would have made more money than I did in the saloons. And I'll tell you something else. When I went to jail, when I went to prison on the big bed, my wife divorced me. I had a baby. We lived in New York. She took the baby and moved to California, 3,000 miles away. While I was in prison, my father died. My mother cried. And I cried too. Yet when I come out of prison, I drank again and went right to the saloons the very first day. What a compulsion that is! But with my cooperation with my God, by cooperating means by me showing up with God and trying to learn and to grow and change, he today, this very day, alcoholism, the drink of alcohol, has no value in my life whatsoever. It's non-attractive to me, not one bit. And that my God, with my cooperation, can take away that powerful compulsion to drink on a daily basis, you tell me that you can't get rid of anger, or resentment, or pity, or get, well, Jimmy, everybody gets angry. Well, everybody drinks too, alcoholics, till they decide that it has no more value in their life. I will always return to that which has value in my life. If a man has value, I shouldn't say this and accuse men, but some go home and bitch at their wives and kids. I'm talking about program people. You know, the autocrat of the family, the big man, you know, the emperor of his home. And he's always got a mean streak in him. See, he sees value in that, and that's why he does it. It's important that his wife cowers. It's important that his kids dive under the table when he comes home. It's important to him. He's a big man in his house. And as long as he keeps that value and that way of life, he will continue to do it. But one day, somehow, some way, because nobody ever thought I would change, and I bet you in your lives no one ever thought any of you would change, he may change and understand what he was doing was valueless. Valueless toward his family and himself. So this is what's important. There isn't a negative emotion that we can't shed or get rid of if we understand that. If you can get rid of your drink a day at a time, if you can get rid of the compulsion to drink a day at a time, if you can take the value off a drink of alcohol a day at a time, if you can be deprived of the attraction of a drink of alcohol a day at a time, you can do anything else in life a day at a time. Until it becomes the natural you, the natural you. Well, Jimmy, it's natural if somebody purposely steps on your foot to want to punch him in the mouth. Well, it used to be. But see, now I know that's a sick mind that would try something like that. I want to get him off my foot. But you do it with understanding. These are not well people. These are sick-minded people. And I don't get angry. I don't get upset. It's hard for someone to understand unless you've been there. You take an athlete that's been in terrific, tremendous physical condition, not just necessarily an athlete, anybody today, and you have never been there, they can't explain that to you, that feeling. You have to get there to understand the real feeling. In the same way with spirituality, and that which to me is a suit of armor around me, see? You talk about, well, if you let that anger in and you hold it in other words, you don't explode, sooner or later you will explode. No, my friends, the secret of that is, and it's not a secret, if it was, I'll reveal it right now. Right now, I don't have to let out that which I never let in. And if there's no value in it, it don't get in. I'm not a doormat. You know, if somebody comes at me with this cane, and I'm going to, you know, I'm not saying we don't have to physically protect ourselves. I'm not talking about it. I'm just talking about everyday living. You don't have to let that stuff in unless you want to and find value in what somebody else said about you. As long as somebody's talking about me and it bothers me, they're doing it again. Every time I think about it, they're doing it again in my mind with my permission, every time I think about it. And if I think about it all day, then I'm taking them to work with me, I'm taking them to lunch with me, this creep that I can't stand, I'm taking them to supper with me. Now listen to this. Now I take the sucker to bed with me. Because when I lay down there, you know, I always said this, there may be a lot of late sleepers in this room, but protect yourselves from this. Most late sleepers, you know, just wake up and stay in bed and wake up and stay in bed. Let their minds go negative. Did you know that? It's a natural thing for the human mind. Let your mind go negative. Don't let it happen. And that's what I'm saying about these people who try to upset you. If I got, you know, I come to these AA rooms. Listen to this. Every day I come here, you know, if I don't make a meeting a day, I read the big book or I talk to people on the phone, either they're talking to me, I'm reaching out to them, or they're reaching out to me. So every day I've got some kind of spiritual growth in my life. Did you know that? Every day I'm growing. And every day I attain a little more spirituality within me, I become more beautiful inside me. Beauty? Yes, it is. The most glorious beauty in the world is spirituality, spiritual concepts. Did you know that? So I become more beautiful inside every day. And I'll be damned if when I leave these AA rooms and go out there in life, I'm going to let someone else's ugliness penetrate my beauty. It ain't going to happen. Now, it might happen to you. I don't know. But it's not going to happen to me. Nobody's going to take away what was so freely given to me from my God, you people in this program. Would you go out there and give it up to some sucker who's thinking and talking like we used to? And you're working his program then, not your own. You've given up your program to get angry and resentful and cry. I'm trying to, you know, there's something about growing up in life, and until I became a spiritually embodied, I didn't know what that was. But I know it now. You know, spirituality is really boldness. I'm very bold in my spirituality. But listen to this. Boldness is, my God asked me to be bold in it, but not in a cocky way. Not in a devil-may-care way. Boldness means in a confident way. And I'm talking very confidently here tonight. If you want to change your life, change your thinking. And there's only one way to change it. Change it into spiritual progress. Spiritual growth. The big book asks us to do one thing. That's when we put down that drink a day at a time. And one thing it don't suggest is that we stay with the same mind. You know, where's Sam? Sam and I used to go up to the jails and the prisons a lot. She saw me spill a drink, he hopped table, so good. He got way over there. But maybe you remember Sam, or maybe he's, I know it's different times. I will tell them inmates, listen to me if this doesn't make sense to you. I say to them guys in the joint, I said, look, when you leave here, meaning either on parole, your time is up or whatever, when you leave here, if you leave here with the same mind that brought you here, you're going to come back. Now, does that make sense or don't? If that don't make sense to you, watch out. You're heading for the slammers. I mean it. In the same way with the AA program, if we contain the same mind that we came in with, we're going to continue to drink. We must change that mind. We must change that thinking. And we don't have to have these negative thoughts. You know, I wake up in the morning and I can look in the mirror, if I dare to. I can look in the mirror, and I'm going to tell you something. Every time I look into a mirror of any kind, I am either looking at my very best friend or my very worst enemy according to the thoughts I have in my mind. And if I have negative thoughts in my mind, I don't need an enemy. I got myself for all day long, for as long as I want to hang on to those negative thoughts. And you are the same way. There's nobody different. Thinking is where it's at, and thinking is what we must do to change our lives. There's no way. You see, thinking, our prior thinking, creates the circumstances in our life. I used to say, somebody would say, Jimmy, you going to have a good day tomorrow or today? And I'd say, I don't know, I got to see what happens. You know, if good things happen, I have a good day. If poor things happen, I have a poor day. I did not know that my mind creates the day. The circumstances at that time were going to let me know whether I was going to have a good day or not. It's like taking a child and sending it out on the highway to fend for itself, and God didn't create me that way. You see, since I changed my thinking and changed my way of life, I wake up every morning now, every morning knowing that I'm going to be a victor over the day rather than a victim of it. And I was a victim of it just too long. Are you sick and tired of being a victim of every day's living? Of what somebody else might say or think or what's going on? Become a victor. The only way you become a victor is through taking on spiritual concepts and spiritual thinking. And that is the victory in this life. And that is the only thing the big book asks us to do after we put down a drink a day at a time. It says spiritual progress. Grow spiritually. And you know, it doesn't say strive for spiritual perfection. But me, I wouldn't mind if it did. I had a friend tell me, he said, well, I wouldn't want to be perfect. It wouldn't be any fun. And I said, well, what you're telling me then is that the closer you go to God, the more boring your life is going to be. Not knowing that I am so excited and dynamic and so powerful, powerfully strong inside, like right now, that there isn't anything that I know can be any better feeling and give me any greater sense of feeling is spiritual fulfillment. So we must grow spiritually. And if we don't, so we lead to perfection. If it leads to perfection, so be it. I said at a meeting a few months ago, I think it was, I said, I don't mind being perfect. I'd like to see what it's like. But I'll tell you one thing, I'd love to do it. And I don't put no, you know, so many people say, well, Jimmy, nobody's perfect, or nobody can have so many days without getting upset or anything. You know, let me tell you something. That's putting a cap on your own life, on your own sobriety, on your own enjoyment. I made a vow that one day, and I don't know whether it's going to be this coming summer or not, but I'm going to walk across Lake Lanier. And I'd like to have you all there to watch me. Now, a guy said, you can't do that. And I said, see? If I say I can't, then I know I can't. But if I say I'm going to do it, there's a chance that I just might. Wow, wouldn't that be something? My God said, these things I do, you can do also, and even greater things. Which means I might roller skate on the way back. Wow! That is available to me. I may never attain that power of spirituality within me. I may not. I'm not saying I won't. If I don't, I don't. But boy, I know it's available to me. Anything in life is available to a person who's growing spiritually. And if my spiritual growth grows to perfection, great. I'd love it. I think it would be just dynamic. But I've often said, you know, there's one thing, the guy says, Jimmy, you can't overcome this. And I said, what's that? And he says, nobody's perfect. Nobody's perfect. I said, nobody's perfect. I said, did you ever go out and see a flat tire, you know, when you're up beholding of that other mind, and it might be raining a little, and you get angry? We know the anger don't come from the tire to you. It's created in your mind and sent out to the tire. Did you know that? Well, you know it now. So anytime you get angry, don't blame the circumstance. You create it in your mind and send it up. Anger isn't something that comes from something else into you. Wow. And I already told you, we can control our thoughts if we take the value off it. Nobody here has to get angry anymore. Unless there's value in it, they will do it. So, I says, well, you know, a guy gets angry. His tire's flat, or this went wrong, or that went wrong, or somebody's got a resentment. Say the anger or the resentment lasts 15 or 20 minutes in the day. When I wake up every morning, my friends, I'm devoid of any real thinking and any improper thought or act when I first wake up in the morning. In my eyes, and right now, while I'm talking to all of you, not just because it's me, but anybody up here talking on spiritual concepts, and if you're listening close, and you're of a spiritual state right now, who's to say at this very moment you're not perfect? All we have to do then is expand upon it. I mean, what the devil? If I can be angry, say he's an angry man for 10 minutes, I can be perfect for 10 minutes. Then maybe the next day I can be perfect for 12 minutes. I don't know. But we are reached certain moments of perfection in every day. And if you don't think you do, then I'm sorry, but I do. I do. I know at times I'm perfect, because my God says I can be perfect. Don't put a cap on anything in life. If you do, you won't attain that which you're trying to attain. A man can only do as well as he thinks he can. That's all. Beyond that, he's in what they call foreign ground, and he don't understand it. We have to think good to feel good. Every emotion is a direct result of a thought. I cannot feel angry in my belly. I cannot feel angry unless first I think angry. I cannot feel sad unless first I think sad. I cannot feel guilty unless first I think guilty. Every thought, every emotion is a direct result of a thought. I can't feel pitiful unless first I think pitiful. Try it. Try it. You'll find out it's true. You can't feel anything down here unless you think it up here first. Now listen to this. This is a good one. I cannot feel cheerful unless first I think cheerful. And I choose my own thoughts, whether I know it or not, or whether I like it or not. Just like the thought of a drink. I don't allow it in my head. You might, I don't. So I don't have a problem with alcohol. Sometimes I have a problem with a big hand and a little hand. Well, I'm going to quiet now. When I was in Auburn prison, I was a company clerk. I couldn't type, but I, you know, learned to get by. That's what us tough guys do, you know. What the hell, 25 cents a day, anybody would fight for that job. And, but like I say, I was changing, and I started reading books, you know. Now, I didn't read these nonsense books. I was reading them on people who kind of made good in life and tried to understand life, and maybe not presidents or CEOs of companies, some were, but just people who bettered themselves. They all talked about this spiritual content they talked about. And, you know, I read this book by Leon Uris called The Agony and the Ecstasy. And The Agony and the Ecstasy was the story of Michelangelo. They made a movie on it later. And Michelangelo was looked upon as the great painter. He did the Sistine Chapel and a few others, but he didn't like to paint. He was a sculptor. He loved marble. He loved to carve statues. He loved the feel of marble. He once said marble was his mistress. I mean, he loved it that much. And so I'll tell you something. So the Pope commissioned him to do that statue of David. And people wonder why that's such a marvel. Well, I had a friend of mine went over to Florence, Italy, and he saw that statue. And in that statue, David is standing with the slingshot over one shoulder. And in the statue, they're telling me, in the marble, you can see on this side where his weight is, you can see and feel the tension in his arms and in the muscle. You can feel the tension. You can see it. And he said, on this side, in the marble, you can feel and sense the relaxation. Michelangelo did that in marble. One side of him was tense and one side was relaxed. And that's some of the genius of this fellow. Well, they unveiled it in front of the Pope and everybody. And they said to Michelangelo, how did you carve such a beautiful statue out of that piece of marble? And he said, I didn't. And they said, you didn't? We know you did. I mean, the Pope commissioned you, and some of us watched you at times working on it. He says, no, I didn't carve that statue out of that marble. He said, that statue was always in that piece of marble. I just chipped away and chipped away and chipped away till I got to it. Then I polished it and refined it, and there's that beautiful piece of work. Now, please believe me, my friends, in closing, all the wonders you seek in life, all the wonders you seek in life are already inside you. It wouldn't be a fair God if I had to travel 200, 300, or 400 miles to find happiness. It's already here. Most people chasing around, especially in relationships from one to another, are trying to find their happiness inside somebody else that ain't there. No more than I can chew and swallow your Wheaties for your nourishment, I can't do that. But it's already in there, and you have to know it. Just quit crowding it and cramping it and stomping it down with negatives. Get rid of those negatives. What we have to do, my friends, is understand that all the good feelings, everyone in this room right now, whether you know it or not, is just as cheerful and joyous as I am. Everyone feels just as powerfully dynamic as I do. Everyone does. Just as some of you don't realize it, some of you don't believe it, some of you won't accept it. So what we have to do is understand that all we have to do is chip away and chip away and chip away at those negatives until they reach that beautiful, beautiful, sound, sober person that's inside you. And everyone can have a good day every day. Thank you.